Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Pod of Their Own listeners, welcome to a very special episode of A Pod of Their Own. So this is episode 23. I am Allison McCaig, and I am once again joined by my co-hosts Linda Surovich and Maggie Wiggin, but I am also joined by Lindsay Adler, and she is our special guest this week. She is a beat writer for The Athletic. She covers the Yankees. You guys know her well from her fantastic work for The Athletic and previously elsewhere. Hi, Lindsay. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we're actually going to start off with a question that I feel like is normally, traditionally toward the end of interviews, but I feel like I want to put this at the top because it's something that I really want our listeners to hear and something that I think that we should highlight that's in sort of keeping with the mission of our show. So who are some non-male writers in sports that you're really excited about right now?
That's a good question. There's a lot. You know, going up to Boston this weekend, I'm always excited to see my colleague, Jen McCaffrey, who I think has a really interesting and creative eye on the Red Sox beat. I mean, really, the thing is, I'm very fortunate to be in New York, where every day I go to work and it's me, Christy Acker, Susan Waldman, and Meredith Marakovic. So I never feel like I'm alone in any way. You know, I would say I basically get through this industry with the help from my friends, Mike Rowley and Emma Beccellieri, who Meg is the managing editor of Fangraphs and Emma is at Sports Illustrated. And I think the three of us with our different, editorial inclinations, hopefully, help each other kind of find some sort of a middle ground. There's a lot, honestly. It's a really great time. I mean, that's just mentioning, you know, a few women, but I actually feel like the field is actually headed in a pretty good direction in terms of overall diversity, not just in terms of demographic, but also in background, or at least that would be my hope.
Well, it's switching gears a little bit, Fred. This is a question for you about your job. Even though you do cover the Yankees, which hurts us a little bit, what has been the most fun thing to cover for you this season?
That's a good question. I think it actually was the Dodgers series last week. I guess by now it'll be about 2 weeks ago. That was, you know, after watching a lot of Orioles baseball, seeing the Yankees face a very good and kind of commensurate team, it was like, oh yeah, there is something really, you know, awesome about, you know, what I get to watch every night. And it was fun. And, you know, LA is LA. And it was my first time at Dodger Stadium. And it was really, really cool, I think. For me, it was really cool.
Allison is a backdoor Orioles fan. So yeah. she felt sorry. That one a little bit. No, we're all sorry.
Yeah, it hurt. It hurt me.
If it makes you feel better, I think the Orioles are doing the right thing. It's just dreadful in the process.
Yeah, they're trying. They'll get there someday.
Hey, I have made my entire Twitter brand identity that trying matters for when it comes to baseball. That has been like the song I'm singing for the last like month and a half. Try all the time. So go, Orioles. Keep trying.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, you know, like I have qualms with the idea of like rebuilding and whatnot. But after last season, I mean, what else could the Orioles have done? To me, they did the right thing. They cleaned house and they actually put themselves on a better path toward contention than they were at this point last year. So, you know what? It's ugly, but this is trying. And I agree with you. I am all for, you know, trying is fine with me.
Well, so you, speaking of trying versus, well, a different kind of trying. So, so you made a lot of writers have made this transition over the years, I feel like, but started with the Mets, who are, shall we say, a unique team full of all kinds of creative, you know, physical threats to reporters in the locker room, for example. Like, it's really, it's a heck of a place to work. And then the Yankees, which is, they seem to actually have their shit together. So that's really special. And I guess I was wondering, like, what does that transition feel like for you? And related, who will we address the petition to get you back on the Mets beat? Because we want you back.
I actually don't think I have the skill set for covering the Mets.
No.
And that is somehow not a slight on the Mets. Well, when I explain it, maybe
it's okay.
Out.
We know.
I think the Yankees beat is easier because at least right now, you know, they're winning. There's everybody across the country says they're a Yankees fan, so there's so much interest in, you know, every person who's on the roster. So it gives, you know, I feel like it gives me a wide range of things to write about. It's definitely, I mean, Yankees fans are actually way more finicky than I had expected, because until like a few years ago, I didn't know any actual Yankees fans. And so I figured they were kind of just like, oh, we won. That's great. You know, we win all the time. That's great. No, they expect to win every single day. But for the most part, they've had enough success that they can be pretty happy with their team. Whereas the Mets, it was difficult for me last year playing time, because I feel like the Mets, you really, really have to be invested in the day in and the day out. And for a wide variety of reasons, there's all sorts of non-baseball things that come up. And it's just, I think the Yankees for right now, as I'm still kind of getting my feet wet on the beat side of things, it allows me to just stick to baseball. Just, you know what, why don't I write about this guy's pitch usage, because that is the most compelling, you know, one of the most compelling storylines versus, you know, over in Queens. I feel like it's, I imagine for the people who are on the beat full time, it can feel like it might only be a matter of time until something blows up. And I actually don't think I have the chops yet to really navigate that as well as I would like to.
When you say something blows up, does that include the fire from last season? Because I think that was just a regular incendiary event.
Yeah, no, I forgot about that. I'd also forgotten about the Port St. Lucie fire.
Yeah, I think a lot of people forgot about that, and I just felt like it was maybe time to unforget about it.
To revisit.
No, I appreciate that.
Where were
that.
You?
I mean, it's true. There are so many strange events over the course of a Mets season. It's good to have, like, I mean, there's probably be like season end recaps, right? You know, remembering all the things that happened to the Mets this year. And not
we'll
just
have
the
that.
Good and the bad, but the truly bizarre.
We'll have that on Wayne's like, Avenue, I think.
I guess it's like doing the recaps for a, like, for like an AMC prestige drama versus doing the recaps for a literal soap opera.
I was going to say, I think that's more of a novel than just your regular recap.
Yeah, right?
So and it would be a dime store novel. It wouldn't be like, you know, wow, this is so bad. I'm a librarian. I'm blanking on author names.
Yeah. Well, it's like when you go up to a comedian, you're like, tell a joke. Yeah, like, go ahead, Linda, say a book. Come on, Linda, say a book.
I don't know. Pride and Prejudice. I don't know.
But so, Lindsay, what was it like, you know, because you talked about how you don't have the chops. For the record, we disagree. We think you do have the chops, and you've proven it.
I appreciate that.
But what was it sort of like having never been a beat writer before to sort of jump right into the, like, for lack of a better phrase, shit show that is the Mets oftentimes?
And just a quick addition to that also for our listeners who might not have followed the arc of your career, if you can also like kind of tell what year you started following the Mets so we can all know exactly what which shit show that you jumped into.
True.
We have so many.
So I was at Deadspin for a few years before being hired by The Athletic to kind of float back and forth between Yankees and Mets. So I split them pretty evenly for the first half of the season. And then the Mets, as I'm sure we all remember, were pretty much out of contention by July or so. And so then I was mostly assigned on Yankees stuff. You know, it was really weird because I think it was like, maybe on one hand, there was a benefit to coming in when there was a new manager and whatnot, but, you know, not being on the beat full time, I don't necessarily know that that made a huge difference, but it was like, you know, what is my place in demonstrating what is going wrong for the Mets when I'm not the primary beat writer? I'm not around all the time. This is my first time even doing this type of work. And like, kind of, it was just like a lot of little feel things. Like, I remember there was a series in Toronto in July. I actually got to go to Toronto for like a full week because they had a Mets series and then a Yankees series. So they just sent me for both at once. Which was awesome because Toronto rules, but there was something that had gone wrong in one of those games. And I think Mickey had mismanaged a bullpen move or something. And I was like, I think I wrote a story that was like critical of how he was like trying to pretend that like there was no issue there, you know, as we've seen Mickey, even as of a couple nights ago, downplay things. And I was like, is this really like the right tone to be striking? And then in retrospect, I was like, yeah, I mean, what did it matter at that point? You know, I feel like it's just a lot of trying to figure out what is the best way to serve the fans, keep a foot in reality, and like, what do you know, how do I quickly develop a perspective that will help, you know, shine a light on things to the Mets or any other team are making, but also, you know, fairly saying, you know, it's as much as the Mets often feel and kind of look like a catastrophe, it's not all bad. They've got a lot of bright lights, which probably for you guys makes it more frustrating, I can imagine. Am I right about that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, yeah, because it's kind of like, I think that the narrative this season has been, and obviously they're not like technically mathematically eliminated yet. They're playing like games that nominally matter in September. So that's already a step in the right direction. However, I think that the narrative, if they miss the playoffs again, will be, you know, we have the presumptive NL Rookie of the Year, a guy that's contending for the batting title and a guy that's contending for his second straight Cy Young, and we still are bad. So.
Yeah. It's incredible, really. I mean, I guess my question for you guys is, like, let's say the Mets finish 2 to 3 games out of wild card contention. Will you guys, I feel like there's two schools of thought, you know, amongst Mets fans. One, you know, oh no, if they come close but then fall short, it's just going to demonstrate back to ownership that, well, this was a successful season, when because they're going home at the end of September, it wasn't. And the other would be more, hey, you know, they kind of gutted it out. They stuck together and they at least were playing meaningful games in September. So I'm curious where you guys fall on that.
That's actually my main fear, is that ownership's going to be like, well, if only, you know, a couple things broke our way, we would have been in the wild card. Mm-hmm. Like, if the bullpen wasn't historically bad, like, it can only get better from here, then we're going to be right in it. But the problem is they always do half measures. Like, they could have traded for Cano and Diaz, but then they also should have signed Kimbrel or signed Machado. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're just always going to be stuck in the same repeated cycle of just doing half measures and never truly trying to build a contender for a long time, especially when you have such a good core, like Allison said.
Well, I sort I'm probably one of the more, I'm going to say optimistic, because that's definitely not how I would characterize my relationship with the Mets, because I think the Mets are, you know, emblematic of just everything that's wrong with today's society, hashtag eat Arby's. But I do sort of feel like what we're seeing, while the Mets are always kind of their own weird, terrible selves, it's not an unusual kind of finish for a team that has in the near past been bad, legitimately bad, and is making boldish steps towards being less bad. And that is a season that's kind of like, okay. And I guess it's, you know, I think the Mets have been so up and down their whole existence, and certainly this season, that it's hard to not get attached to the really good and the really bad, to kind of live that whole roller coaster existence. But I do sort of feel like this is looking like a season that doesn't really call for, you know, amazing, brilliant happiness or absolute traumatic misery. Like, that it really is a season where you can be like, okay, well, some things are starting to work well for them. They are significantly better than they were last year. Like, quite. Last year was quite bad. Mm-hmm. And that they're, like, almost everything that was good about this season will still be there next season. Like, that's the other thing that makes me kind of feel like this is not, I think in a lot of ways it's almost like 2015 minus the absolute gangbuster addition at the deadline. And that's not, you know, to nothing against Marcus Stroman, but like Yoenis Cespedes came here in 2015 and, you know, hit the world and like propelled the team all the way to the World Series. And, you know, there was just no everyday force that appeared like that for the Mets this year. And 2015 was also a year where it was kind of, they were better earlier than we thought they were going to be. And then it was wonderful when they were, but then it petered out really quickly and left us back to this feeling of like, well, either the Mets are going to go to the World Series or they're going to be the worst team ever. And we don't really know how to cope in between there. So my incredibly long-winded way of going about saying is that, like, I think it's a team that's taking steps forward in a way that's actually not all that unusual around the league. Like, this is maybe where the Brewers were a few years ago. And like, yeah, you'd like to see the Mets run, you know, a little more richly than the Brewers. I don't know. But I don't think there's a lot to be ashamed about. I mean, like, chair throwing aside, I don't think there's a lot to be ashamed about for the Mets for this season. I think, like, there's reason to feel good about next season, and it's been a long time since that was the case.
Yeah, I never thought I would find myself being accused of being a front office apologist like I have in the past, like, week or so. But I found myself strangely on the other side of the argument, which is very new for me, because obviously, you know, us Mets fans are used to being pretty cynical and pretty critical of the front office and of ownership. But what I do think this all goes back to is the concept of, you know, trying is good. And I think that the approach at the deadline of going for it and getting Stroman is good for the game as a whole. And it made me excited that my team, even if it confused the heck out of people at the time, was a force for a more positive change in the game, where more teams are going for it and trying instead of just waving the white flag and giving up. So I was kind of actually weirdly proud of that. And so I was an advocate for doing that, which, you know, people on Twitter called me a front office apologist for that because the Mets weren't, you know, tearing it all down and admitting.
Allison.
Yeah, right.
Such a bootlicker, jeez.
Bootlicker. The Mets weren't tearing it all down and admitting failure and, you know, folding it. Like, trying is good. I like that the Mets saw this core and thought, well, we may have screwed up the offseason, but we're still going to try. And I think that as bad as the Wilpons are in almost every facet of everything in owning a team, the one thing that I will never admonish them for is the fact that I actually do think that they want to win and they have no desire to tank.
They're just bad at it.
They're just bad at it. Yeah.
Well, and I also think, like, the idea that the Mets should be tearing it down right now is absolutely ludicrous.
Ludicrous.
And if they have the collection of young talent that they do, including some players who are going to be gone in 2 years, but like if they have that level of talent and they are selling it off, then contract the Mets forever, because that is absolute bullshit. So that is, you know, you could go back and forth on what kind of moves they should be making, but the idea that they should tear this down is crazy. And even if they did that, even if they sold off everybody for all the best prospects, like, a best case scenario is they get back to this place with those prospects.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I do think it's a really interesting season because, if the Mets finish a couple games out of it, what we're going to remember from this year is, you know, five years down the line. Well, I don't know what you guys are going to remember, because Mets fans seem to have the best memories on earth for, you know, injustices against them, understandably.
I could map out Luis Castillo's dropped pop-up in Yankee Stadium. I could map it on a chart of the infield right now. I won't, though.
Yeah, for me, in 5 years, I'll probably remember a team that most likely finished above 500, had Pete Alonso, had Jacob DeGrom. It's going to take me a long time to forget that walk-off loss the other night. But also, you know, this is a team that didn't look like they were going anywhere earlier in the year, and they actually didn't quit on themselves. They didn't quit on Mickey. They didn't quit on the front office. Like, they kept going. And I think ultimately, like, I wouldn't be surprised if this Mets team, if unsuccessful for the goal every team should be striving for, even if unsuccessful, I mean, I think they'll be remembered favorably. Or at least I would hope so. There's been enough bright spots. And I mean, I imagine that's a pretty weird position for you guys to be in, where at least in recent years, the Mets have been kind of boom or bust. And there hasn't been we gave it a darn effort, you know, and we came up short, but, you know, we respected the purity of the process of playing it out type of season. And it's interesting. I really, a few months ago, I wouldn't have expected them to be in this position.
Yeah, I was at the first game against the Nationals, I think the beginning of August. I think it was August 9th it was. And it was the game when Frazier hit the home run off Doolittle, and then Conforto walked it off. And the stadium was electric. Stroman was electric because that was his first home start. The crowd was just insane from the first pitch. And you could kind of see the relationship between the players and the crowd and how they fed off of it. And I'm thankful that that happened. Like, that wasn't, I haven't had that experience in the stadium for so long, and how much fun it really was, and the playoff like atmosphere. And so, you know, they might fall short. I'm preparing myself for them to fall short, but you know what? I'm still thankful that they did go on that run, because like we said, they tried and they didn't give up. And that's, what more can you ask for as a baseball fan, really? But my question.
Having a rooting interest. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No. Go ahead.
That was a very entertaining game. I wonder if it's actually the spiritual analog to the walk-off loss the other night.
It kind of was.
Yeah, right?
I mean, it's so deep.
Both sides have dealt with the, like, you know, crushing walk-off loss.
Well, there's this, I'm on vacation currently down the Jersey Shore, and there's this roller coaster that, like, there's just this, it's a drop, like, straight down. So I can only imagine, like, that's, like, I can't think of a better analogy of what the season is. Like, you're exhilarated, you're high, then you fall down, and then you're also completely nauseous and at your lowest point, like, feeling sick. Like,
well, and Lindsay, you also have to understand, that walk-off loss, that was our recording night.
Yeah.
So while we were recording, ooh, everything was great. And then we finished, ooh, recording, and it only got better from there. And then it stopped. And it was like, and of course, so that happened before the episode dropped. So we had this, oh no, like, we had happy, this episode that was like 85% irrelevant at this point.
Yep.
But it was, but you got to drop it. It's going, it's out there. So, so that was sort of the background to this loss, was just that it, like, it straddled our recording schedule so perfectly.
Yep.
It's incredible.
When you start losing your hair, there's no magical cure. But there is a way to stop hair loss from happening in the first place. It's called Keeps, and it's a treatment that's proven up to 90% effective at reducing and stopping further hair loss. You don't have to go to the doctor's office or stand in line at the pharmacy for a prescription. You'll visit a doctor online, and they'll send the medication right to you in a discreet package. And with Keeps starting at just $10 a month, you don't have to go broke to avoid going bald. 2 out of 3 guys will experience some form of male pattern baldness by the time they're 35. So prevention is key. The sooner you start using Keeps, the more hair you'll save. Nearly 100,000 men trust Keeps for their hair loss prevention medication. They have more 5-star reviews than any of their competitors. So take action now and visit keeps.com/SBNation. With our special offer, you'll receive your first month of treatment for free at keeps.com/SBNation. That's KEEPS.com/SBNation.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
So we were talking a little bit about, you know, this core the Mets have. Do you think it could compare to the Yankees core that they have? Do you think that's something the Mets should aspire to? Like, because the Yankees do have, you know, their sluggers, and I think Alonso holds up pretty well against them, maybe even a little better. But do you think they're comparable, or yeah, just your thoughts on that?
I don't know. It's hard for me to compare, probably because I've watched the Yankees so up close and honestly watch a lot of Mets baseball too. But I think, you know, like you said, like, ownership with the Mets makes mistakes, but they do care. And I think, you know, I think the way the Yankees approach their quote-unquote rebuild is actually a pretty good model for most teams in the league. You know, the Yankees are in the position where they can just eat Jacoby Ellsbury's, you know, enormous salary if he doesn't play for 2 years. And so obviously there's a lot of, you know, and it's not like their payroll is insignificant this year. It's very, very high, but like, I think there is a good guide for how teams with less financial flexibility can go about it. And having Pete for the foreseeable future and having, you know, Jacob deGrom, you know, locked up in a more fair deal. Yeah, I think there is a good chance that this is, you know, part of the Mets core that we could see, you know, really contending sooner rather than later. Do I think that maybe Mickey is the manager for that? I don't really know. I don't really know that he still quite understands this market. But in terms of the players, and I guess really the thing that Brody and Omar and, you know, all those hopefully useful new front office additions to the team, you know, they just got to build the farm system. And obviously that took a significant hit with the Cano trade, but or at least a notable hit, maybe not significant across the spectrum, but one we'll be thinking about for a while. But I wouldn't be surprised seeing this, a team that looks fairly similar to this with a better bullpen and some more productive veteran pieces, you know, taking off eventually or soon enough.
Maggie, you literally said that.
Shocked me at all.
Yeah. No, it could. I think it feels like a good framework. But Lindsay, you actually mentioned something. You mentioned the farm system, and that's something I'm always so, you know, as someone pretty outside like the Yankees conversations. You know, the Yankees mm-hmm. are a team. They're always really good. Almost always very, very good. And they have a really solid farm system, and they seem to always be churning out really quality prospects and have like 10 more waiting. And like, what do they do? How do they, you know, given how MLB, you know, draft rules are structured, like what's their secret to having so much talent in the minors while still competing at the highest level in the majors? Like, can the Mets do it too? Like, what's the secret?
part of it is that the Yankees are just a very, very, very smart team, and they have a huge baseball operations and player development departments, and they can provide all sorts of resources for these guys. And, you know, one thing, there's so many things about baseball financials that I wish I could know, just to, you know, understand how it looks throughout the league. And so I don't actually know if any team really is different from the Yankees in this regard, but the Yankees have the luxury of being able to take flyers on, you know, say international signings, and just invest heavily, heavily, heavily in player development. And my understanding is that they are very good at this point at kind of keeping, I guess the nerdy way to put it would be a vertical integration throughout their entire system. You know, the major league hitting coaches work well with the minor league hitting coaches, and I think that's contributed to some of the success they've seen from some of the kind of, you know, as they call themselves, next men up. If I knew, I would love to tell you, but seriously, every time someone like Mike Ford has a big game, I'm like, okay, seriously, what the hell? But I think the thing that people, yeah, I am as shocked as everyone else. But I think the thing people don't see, and I didn't see until I was close up, is just the amount of depth they have, in a way that it's like, you know, they wanted some international signing money, or they, you know, felt like for whatever reason they dealt a AAA first baseman to the Royals, where he immediately got called up despite having probably no real future in the Yankees org. And so they're, you know, through their depth in the minors, and especially because I think the Yankees have a pretty good reputation in terms of, you know, talent acquisition and player development. Maybe not as much when it comes to pitchers, but I think they're really able to do a lot with some of the hidden pieces that people who don't follow the Yankees all that closely, or even some who do, you know, I think there's a lot of small things that just really add up for them. And I'm not sure if that's a, you know, financial resourcing. I don't necessarily know what the thorough line is with that. But yeah, depth has bailed them out this year. And really, I can see now from my position how well it sets them up in the future.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Speaking of being in your position, I'm going to change gears a little bit and ask you about social media, because another big theme on this podcast that we've talked about in the past is online harassment and people just being generally assholes on Twitter. So how do you deal with people being trash on Twitter?
You know, I don't have that many people. Well, I approach it in a lot of different ways. One, I mostly vent to my friends privately. Two, I have it set up so that on my phone, it only shows me notifications from people I follow. So I only see my full notifications on TweetDeck during games. You know, people aren't that shitty to me at this point. People have been in the past, and I'm sure there's a lot that I don't see. But the only real thing that's been a big adjustment this year is that people just are really crabby when the team's having a bad loss or something like that. And so figuring out, okay, no, everyone's really sensitive and will jump on any small mistake I make. But mostly I just try to, like, it gets really overwhelming. Because even if it's people tweeting positive things that some Yankees hitter has done or whatever, it's just like a high volume of other people's thoughts on baseball. And yeah, I really try to take any opportunity I can to do something where I won't be able to look at the internet. I've really, this year, I think I kind of got to a point where I'm like, okay, you know, this isn't, you know, engaging with people who are rude to me or are rude in general is not actually doing anything to make me more productive or smarter or whatever. And so if I'm baking, I can't be looking at stupid memes. If I'm reading a book, then I'm hopefully learning about something other than, you know, what's going on in a random Red Pirates game. You know, just things like that. I'm really trying to say from, you know, kind of all sides of social media, like, you know, I don't need this so much.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And do you feel that like players in the clubhouse are like more accepting than fans? I mean, I know that you mentioned that you're really lucky to be on the Yankees beat because you're around Susan Waldman and others that have like trailblazed, you know, in this area. Do you think that the environment in the clubhouse is getting better, especially for women? And like, do you think, how does that compare to how you interact with the fans? Like, are the players more accepting than they used to be?
You know, I think, actually, I have a story for you guys. Last year, I said something to Todd Frazier because I think he had posted a cute Instagram video of his daughter or something like that. And I was like, oh, you know, your daughter's funny, or I liked her outfit, or I don't know, something. And he was like, oh, thanks. You know, she really, you know, she wants to come in here and hang out, you know, with me and my teammates, but they don't let ladies. And then he stopped himself and he's like, little ladies in here. And I was like,
that's not better, Todd.
That is accidentally the best thing you could say to me. You just see me as any, you know, annoying reporter, regardless of gender. You didn't even think about that when saying that. And that's really kind of all I want. I think players are not often too keen to deal with us. And that's kind of the perspective I have, is if you find me, you can take issue with me for actions I do, and you can just not really want to deal with me because I'm a reporter, but don't make it about my gender. And really, I kind of think that's what it is. I mean, I'm never really going to know, but no one's shitty to me. People in there treat me with respect. I think this year, as we've gotten to know each other a lot more than last year, they kind of have a better sense of what I'm about and that I'm not trying to trap them as much. And so I don't know. I mean, if there is a big gender component in the clubhouse, I don't really have the proper knowledge of it with fans. I think, again, I don't know if this is a Yankees thing because they're having a great season or what, but like, they're pretty much just happy to learn anything about their team from anyone. So, you know, as long as to them, I'm a conduit to finding out, you know, if Aaron Judge did something nice or clever, or if he, you know, made a really nice play. I don't think most of them care, or at least I hope not. And I think there's enough people who care so much about the baseball that if someone said something shitty and sexist to me, a lot of Yankees fans would be like, bro, she tells us what Tommy Canley's wearing. Back the fuck off. So that's kind of unfortunate dynamic. Yeah, where I'm just like, you know what, just as long as you just want to use me to learn about your favorite players, then there's probably not many problems here.
Well, that's comforting to hear. I'm going to switch gears again a little bit. You mentioned you read, and we love reading. We're very bookish here. And as I said, I'm a librarian. So is there anything interesting you're reading now?
So a mistake I made last year was not doing enough that wasn't work-related. And so in spring, I decided I needed to find a new creative pursuit. And so now I am into art, despite not actually understanding art. So I've been working on a big, long biography of Van Gogh that's really fascinating. And it's, like, really frustrating because he, like, truly sucked. Like, we all know Van Gogh sucked, but, like, it's, like, tedious to read how much he sucked. So I've mostly been sticking with, like, art books or art biographies and stuff this year. And I think it's reading a super long book during the season. You know, I'm like, yeah, I want to do this as an accomplishment, so it makes it easier to read. But also I'm like, damn, I'm trying to read a really long book in, like, the most important part of the season. Am I nuts? So
that's kind of what interest you in this pamphlet. It is two sides.
Yeah, basically I'm like, I don't know anything about this dude, but I like his colors. And now I'm kind of realizing, like, actually maybe I should have started, like, you know, with a biography of Monet, where maybe the correlation between his persona and his art was maybe a little bit more direct. But yeah, that's basically been what I'm doing. I was very happy to learn that new Yankees reliever Corey Guerin is actually a big book guy, and he dreams of one day aspiring infinite jest, but is intimidated by the footnotes. So I'm like, hell yeah, I got my people.
Yes, that's the reason I haven't read Infinite Jest, is because I was like, I hate books with too many footnotes in them that aren't nonfiction.
So my husband actually did read Infinite Jest. He is, to my knowledge, the only living American who has actually read the book. And
fellow Mason Avenue writer Michael has read Infinite Jest.
See? Oh, Michael.
Yes. So we have two.
But also, David said it wasn't worth it. Now, I don't know if he's saying that just so that he can maintain status as the only living American who has read Infinite Jest. It would be a very sly move. But yeah, so that is straight from the horse's mouth. It's fine, not great.
Interesting. I've heard that once you get past the first 100 pages, you start cruising, but I just get so upset about his vocabulary that I'm like, fuck, how am I ever going to learn all these words? And so then I just stop. I can't do it. It makes me too insecure. I'm like, how did this crazy man pack all of this knowledge into his brain? What is wrong with me? I need to go sit by a pond and think about my life. Which is a little bit dramatic, but that is how I am.
That sounds like really more of an off-season read.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, true.
Have any of you guys finished Power Broker?
No.
Nope.
Is that worth it?
I'm blanking out on what book that even is. I'm like, I know the name. What is that book?
It's Robert Caro's book about, holy shit, why can't I remember his name now?
We are all baseball people on an off day, and we are partially present at this point. But
yeah, just the New York centric podcast where I can't remember Robert Moses's name. But no, I'm actually kind of thinking about giving that one a shot, because I read Robert Caro's book on writing, and he kind of talks about why he was interested in some stuff about like the creation of the, you know, FDR. And then I've taken the FDR a couple times since, and I'm like, maybe I should read The Power Broker. And then the other side of my brain is like, no, what are you doing? That book is like 1400 pages.
That's a lot of pages.
So if anyone wants to off-season book club it with me, I could really use some support.
That was literally one of our plans for the off-season, was a book club.
Okay, cool.
So you're with your people. I don't know if that will necessarily be one of our picks, but maybe.
Yeah, maybe you guys have some more reasonable ideas than I do, where I'm like, oh, 900 pages, 1400 pages. I guess this is what I should do.
Yeah, we'll loop you in. So my last question, because we can't miss this one, is we love Fisher, and tell all of our listeners about Fisher and how he's the best.
Okay, Fisher's weird because he like actually has a personality, and I don't really understand it. I actually would like to see like a somewhere between a psychologist and a dog behaviorist so that they could tell me if I'm projecting a personality onto Fisher or if he actually has one. I actually have no idea, but he's pretty good. He can kind of tell that I'm packing to leave for another road trip, and so he looks not happy with me. Mm-hmm. But I was kind of in a bad mood today, and then he's like, he kind of looks like he might be an emotional support dog, but really he's like, oh, you're sad. Maybe you should try rubbing my belly, bitch. And I'm like, okay, great. Thanks. I'm glad that I do everything for you just for you to like not give a shit that I'm crying over Queer Eye or whatever.
Oh my God.
It's a little emotional vampire.
Yeah. What's wrong with her? Why isn't she just throwing my toy? But mostly he's a good boy. He doesn't embarrass me too often, and he's nice and literally always around just staring at me if I need company, like in a one bedroom apartment. I can't get away from him just staring at me because he's a dog, so he can't watch TV, so he has nothing else to do, I guess, which was not actually something I realized before getting a dog, was that he was just going to stare at me. So that's basically the Fisher experience.
They do stare at you a lot.
I am his emotional support animal.
Oh no.
Poor Fisher. What kind of breed is he?
He's a Japanese Spitz and Pomeranian.
No. Crying over Queer Eye is definitely also a mood, because not gonna lie, that's happened to me even recently. So
I was gonna say like today?
Yeah, like maybe today.
Yeah, this season didn't get me as badly, but I can't remember. There was one of them. It might have been the sports liker guy where I was like, oh, this is really sad. Wasn't as emotional for me as the other ones, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So instead of crying, what we're going to do is we're going to take a short break. And when we get back, we will do, as we always do, walk off wins, where each of us talks about what's making us happy this week, baseball related or otherwise. And Lindsay will give us her walk off win after we give ours to show her how to show her the ropes on walk off wins. So stay tuned.
Hey, I'm Neil Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, host of The Vergecast. We've been revamping The Vergecast more and more lately, and we're coming out with episodes twice a week, sometimes even a third bonus episode. On Tuesdays, I talk to influential people around the world of tech, like Microsoft founder Bill Gates and other tech execs like the founder of Lime Scooters, the CEO of Beyond Meat. We've also been talking to a lot of reporters and academics about the major pressing policy issues in tech, like Facebook's content moderation, they're not doing great, YouTube's harassment plan, or lack thereof, and whether or not the government should break up Amazon, which... maybe it should. And then every Friday, I sit down with executive editor Dieter Bohn and Paul Miller for our chat show. We cover the latest in tech news and product reviews. We bring in our other reporters from around The Verge. That show is a party. You should listen to it. You can hear all that and more if you subscribe to The Vergecast wherever you get your podcast. We'd love for you to listen and join us. So again, subscribe to The Vergecast wherever you get your podcast. We'll see you there.
This is Kara Swisher. I want to tell you about my podcast, Recode Decode. Every week, we have candid, in-depth conversations with people like Elon Musk, Nancy Pelosi, and Kathy Griffin. We talk about how they got to where they are today and how their work is changing our world. New episodes of Recode Decode are released every Monday and Wednesday, and we often have bonus episodes on Friday. Subscribe for free to be the first to hear them on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
And we are back. As I said, it is time for walk-off wins, where each of us talks about what is making us happy this week. Maggie, what is your walk-off win for this week?
So my walk-off win is that today was Tommy's first day of kindergarten. I won't say like, oh, it went perfectly well, because that would be a lie, and I don't believe in lying to my listeners. But it went really well. And he was so excited to be there. And like, once he was actually there and in his classroom, he was having a wonderful time. He ran the whole way. Like, our school is now walking distance from our apartment, so that is aces. And he just ran the whole way. And it was just, you know, it was really sweet. And the school is, he's in such a good school. It's really well suited for like his learning needs. And it's just wonderful. And I'm so proud of him. And yay, Tommy, way to go. So that's my walk-off win, is kindergarten is great.
Yay, Tommy, first day of school.
That's a big deal. Yay, Maggie. Yay.
So Linda, what is your walk-off win for this week?
Mine is Pete Alonso, just because. because the two articles came out today, one by The Athletic and one by Sports Illustrated. There were two profiles on Pete that came out today. And he just loves baseball. Like, they're such good reads. Everybody should go read them. I never thought we would have another David Wright. Because he was just so rare and so special and so unique. But I feel like Pete can maybe not achieve that level, but he might be the one who comes closest because of his work ethic, his confidence, his relationship with the fans. He's just fun. And it's nice to have another fun player who genuinely loves the game and has fun playing the game and remembers it's a child's game, like showing emotion on the field, celebrating home runs, bat flipping. Like, I'm thankful that he's a New York Met. And, you know, he, like I said, he might not be David Wright, but it's nice knowing we might have another cornerstone piece for the foreseeable future.
It's awesome. Pete Alonso is so good. And those articles are both so good. Like, they have classic lines. Like, there's one that's like, he just wants to play Led Zeppelin and hit giant dingers. And I'm like, oh my God, as if I couldn't love you more. And then there's one that's like, he could eat a baseball.
Yes! That's the one that got me. If baseballs were edible, he would eat one.
I was like,
that's
what?
Right up there with the one, that's right up there with the one on The Ringer earlier this season where they said he looked like he could play a log cabin on a children's TV show on his off days.
It's amazing. So speaking of players that exude joy playing the game, my walk-off win this week is Robinson Cano. He is, I don't care what the haters say about the trade, I will never apologize for being a Robinson Cano stan. I absolutely will not. I love him. And he is finally back. He's Superman. He tore a hamstring in theory, and he's playing, which nobody expected. And in his first day back, he went 3-for-3 with a walk, had 2 RBIs, and scored 2 runs. And this was right after the absolute hell disaster walk-off loss game. Brought us right back up again, buying in again, as always, only to be heartbroken later. But I'm just really happy to see Robinson Cano playing again, because I think that these last few weeks, even if the Mets fall short of the playoffs, one of like my wish list beyond like the Mets making the playoffs, number one is seeing Robinson Cano have a solid 3 weeks, because he's on the team for the next 4 years, whether you like the trade or not. And seeing him perform is going to be really awesome, and I believe that he will, and I believe that it will make me optimistic about his future on the Mets. So I'm really pumped that he already looks like he's hitting his stride again, despite the torn hamstring and coming back early from it and looking so good. So that's my walk-off win. Lindsay, what is your walk-off win?
Mine is less inspiring, but there was a pair of Kyrie 4s that came out, I think it was maybe this time last year. I can't remember. I don't know. That said, that were teal, and they had the basketball on the back tab turned into a Venus symbol, and it said, and you know, all over the shoes, it said power is female. Ooh. And despite Kyrie being a flat earther, and despite them not making the power is female shoes in women's sizes, I was still like, yeah, it has a Venus symbol. And I'd been thinking about buying them, and then, but I hadn't done it because I would have had to buy them secondhand, and they were inexpensive, and like, I'm not a person who wears like actual basketball shoes. But I was in LA and the team had gone up to Seattle, and I had stayed back for a couple days, and John and I were walking, and we were walking down Sunset, and his best friend from high school turned into the parking lot at the crossroads, which I hadn't planned on going in. And she was like, oh, hey, come in with me. And we went in, and I found the Kyrie Powers Females in my size for $35.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
that's the kind of thing like I would dream about. I would dream about finding my like perfect shoes in my size for $35. Ugh, love it.
That reminds me very much of an experience I had. I think it was like springtime this year. It was like maybe like March-ish this year. I was like walking down the street. It was like in the, I still lived in Baltimore at the time. I no longer do, but, I was walking down the street in like, you know, an area with like lots of, shops, like one after the other, after the other. And I was going to a very specific shop cause I wanted to buy my friend a birthday gift. So I was like on a mission, knew exactly what I wanted. And I walked by a store window, and it had this dress just like hanging in the window. It was a long sleeve sweater dress covered in sloths. And I was like, what? And I had like one of those like moments you see in a movie where I like walked by the window, stopped, walked backwards, and like stared in the window, and like immediately went inside. And it's still like one of my favorite dresses that I own. I was like, oh my goodness. So
awesome.
Love those moments like that. Lindsay, just to wrap things up, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at twitter.com/Lindsay Adler. And you can also find me at The Athletic. If you go to theathletic.com/NYC, you will find the Pete Alonso story that deservedly was spoken so highly of, and then also the stuff I write about the Yankees. So that is my selling point. Maybe that's not the best pitch I've ever made, but yeah, I exist.
You all should check out Lindsay's work. She's fantastic. I read her Yankee stuff, which goes to show how much I love her writing, because I never thought I would read anything about the Yankees, but I do because Lindsay writes it. So that does it for our show this week. You guys got two shows this week. Spoiled, spoiled. Next week it'll be back to one show, we promise. But in the meantime, you can go to amazingavenue.com to get all of your Mets-related content. You should especially go there right now because we have a fundraiser update for you. So go to amazingavenue.com, find information about our Dollars for Dingers fundraiser, our Dollars for Dingers fundraiser, about our McKellar event at the end of the month. Go find the details there. Also, obviously, all of our game recaps, morning news posts, analysis, other Mets content. You can find Amazing Avenue on all the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can find me on Twitter at Petite PhD. Where can we find you, Maggie?
At Maggie162.
And you, Linda?
At Linda Servage.
You can also find the show on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own. You can email the show aa.apodoftheirown@gmail.com. Please send us emails. We love to hear from you. And you can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe and rate and review the show. It really helps other people find it. The original music for this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go Mets. And don't forget, there is no time.
Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.